records of the numerous adherents who were attached to his fortune and had been promoted by his venal favour. For their mutual defence he contrived the safeguard of a law which violated every principle of humanity and justice. 1. It is enacted in the name and by the authority of Arcadius that all those who should conspire either with subjects or with strangers against the lives of any of the persons whom the emperor considers as the members of his own body shall be punished with death and confiscation. This species of fictitious and metaphorical treason is extended to protect not only the illustrious officers of the state and army, who were admitted into the sacred consistory, but likewise the principal domestics of the palace, the senators of Constantinople, the military commanders, and the civil magistrates of the provinces. A vague and indefinite list, which, under the successors of Constantine, included an obscure and numerous train of subordinate ministers. 2. This extreme severity might perhaps be justified, had it been only directed to secure the representatives of the sovereign from any actual violence in the execution of their office. But the whole body of imperial dependents claimed a privilege, or rather, impunity, which screened them in the loosest moments of their lives from the hasty, perhaps the justifiable, resentment of their fellow citizens, and by a strange perversion of the laws, the same degree of guilt and punishment was applied to a private quarrel and to a deliberate conspiracy against the emperor and the empire. The edicts of Arcadius most positively and most absurdly declares that in such cases of treason, thoughts and actions ought to be punished with equal severity, and that the knowledge of a mischievous intention, unless it be instantly revealed, becomes equally criminal with the intention itself, and that those rash men who shall presume to solicit the pardon of traitors shall themselves be branded with public and perpetual infamy. 3. With regard to the sons of the traitors, continues the emperor, although they ought to share the punishment, since they will probably imitate the guilt of their parents, yet, by the special effect of our imperial lenity, we grant them their lives. But at the same time, we declare them incapable of inheriting either on the father's or on the mother's side, or of receiving any gift or legacy from the testament either of kinsmen or of strangers. Stigmatized with hereditary infamy, excluded from the hopes of honors or fortune, let them endure the pangs of poverty and contempt, till they shall consider life as a calamity, and death as a comfort and relief. In such words, so well adapted to insult the feelings of mankind, did the emperor, or rather his favorite eunuch, applaud the moderation of a law which transferred the same unjust and inhuman penalties to the children of all those who had seconded or who had not disclosed their fictitious conspiracies. Some of the noblest regulations of Roman jurisprudence have been suffered to expire, but this edict, a convenient and forcible engine of ministerial tyranny, was carefully inserted in the codes of Theodosius and Justinian, and the same maxims have been revived in modern ages to protect the electors of Germany and the cardinals of the Church of Rome. Yet these sanguinary laws, which spread terror among a disarmed and dispirited people, were of too weak a texture to restrain the bold enterprise of Tribergelt, the Ostrogoth, the colony of that warlike nation which had been planted by Theodosius in one of the most fertile districts of Phrygia, impatiently compare the slow returns of laborious husbandry with the successful rapine and liberal rewards of Alaric, and their leader resented as a personal affront his own ungracious reception in the palace of Constantinople. A soft and wealthy province in the heart of the empire was astonished by the sound of war, and the faithful vassal who had been disregarded or oppressed was again respected as soon as he resumed the hostile character of a barbarian. The vineyards and fruitful fields between the rapid Marsyas and the winding Meander were consumed with fire. The decayed walls of the cities crumbled into dust at the first stroke of an enemy. The trembling inhabitants escaped from a bloody massacre to the shores of the Hellespont, and a considerable part of Asia Minor was desolated by the rebellion of Tribigild. His rapid progress was checked by the resistance of the peasants of Pamphylia, and the Ostrogoths attacked in a narrow pass between the city of Selgi, a deep morass, and the craggy cliffs of Mount Taurus, were defeated with the loss of their bravest troops. But the spirit of their chief was not daunted by misfortune, and his army was continually recruited by swarms of barbarians and outlaws who were desirous of exercising the profession of robbery under the more honorable names of war and conquest. The rumors of the success of Tribigild might for some time be suppressed by fear or disguised by flattery, yet they gradually alarmed both the court and the capital. Every misfortune was exaggerated in dark and doubtful hints, and the future designs of the rebels became the subject of anxious conjecture. Whenever Tribigild advanced into the inland country, the Romans were inclined to suppose that he meditated the passage of Mount Taurus and the invasion of Syria. If he descended towards the sea, they imputed, and perhaps suggested to the Gothic chief, the more dangerous project of arming a fleet in the harbours of Ionia, and of extending his depredations along the maritime coast from the mouth of the Nile to the port of Constantinople. The approach of danger, and the obstinacy of Tribigild, who refused all terms of accommodation, compelled Eutropius to summon a council of war. After claiming for himself the privilege of a veteran soldier, the eunuch entrusted the guard of Thrace and the Hellespont to Gainas the Goth, and the command of the Asiatic army to his favorite Leo. Two generals who differently but effectually promoted the cause of the rebels. Leo, who from the bulk of his body and the dullness of his mind was surnamed the Ajax of the East, had deserted his original trade of a wool comber to exercise with much less skill and success the military profession, and his uncertain operations were capriciously framed and executed with an ignorance of real difficulties and a timorous neglect of every favorable opportunity. The rashness of the Ostrogoths had drawn them into a disadvantageous position between the rivers Milas and Eurymedon, where they were almost besieged by the peasants of Pamphylia. But the arrival of an imperial army, instead of completing their destruction, afforded the means of safety and victory. Tribigild surprised the unguarded camp of the Romans in the darkness of the night, seduced the faith of the greater part of the barbarian auxiliaries, and dissipated without much effort the troops which had been corrupted by the relaxation of discipline and the luxury of the capital. The discontent of Gainas, who had so boldly contrived and executed the death of Rufinus, was irritated by the fortune of his unworthy successor. He accused his own dishonorable patience under the servile reign of a eunuch, and the ambitious Goth was convicted, at least in the public opinion, of secretly fomenting the revolt at Tribigild, with whom he was connected by a domestic as well as by a national alliance. When Gainas passed the Hellespont to unite under his standard the remains of the Asiatic troops, he skillfully adapted his motions to the wishes of the Ostrogoths, abandoning by his retreat the country which they desired to invade, or facilitating by his approach the desertion of the barbarian auxiliaries. To the imperial court he repeatedly magnified the valor, the genius, the inexhaustible resources of Tribigild, confessed his own inability to prosecute the war, and extorted the permission of negotiating with his invincible adversary. The conditions of peace were dictated by the haughty rebel, and the peremptory demand of the head of Eutropius revealed the author and the design of this hostile conspiracy. Part 2. The bold satirist who has indulged his discontent by the partial and passionate censure of the Christian emperors violates the dignity rather than the truth of history by comparing the son of Theodosius to one of those harmless and simple animals who scarcely feel that they are the property of their shepherd. Two passions, however, fear and conjugal affection, awakened the languid soul of Arcadius. He was terrified by the threats of a victorious barbarian, and he yielded to the tender eloquence of his wife Eudoxia, who, with a flood of artificial tears, presenting her infant children to their father, implored his justice for some real or imaginary insult which she imputed to the audacious eunuch. The emperor's hand was directed to sign the condemnation of Eutropius. The magic spell, which during 4 years had bound the prince and the people, was instantly dissolved. Then the acclamations that so lately hailed the merit and fortune of the favorite were converted into the clamors of the soldiers and people who reproached his crimes and pressed his immediate execution. In this hour of distress and despair, his only refuge was in the sanctuary of the church, whose privileges he had wisely or profanely attempted to circumscribe. And the most eloquent of the saints, John Chrysostom, enjoyed the triumph of protecting a prostrate minister whose choice had raised him to the ecclesiastical throne of Constantinople. The archbishop, ascending the pulpit of the cathedral, that he might be distinctly seen and heard by an innumerable crowd of either sex and of every age, pronounced a seasonable and pathetic discourse on the forgiveness of injuries and the instability of human greatness. The agonies of the pale and affrighted wretch who lay groveling under the table of the altar exhibited a solemn and instructive spectacle, and the orator, who was afterwards accused of insulting the misfortunes of Eutropius, labored to excite the contempt that he might assuage the fury of the people. The powers of humanity, of superstition, and of eloquence prevailed. The Empress Eudoxia was restrained by her own prejudices, or by those of her subjects, from violating the sanctuary of the church. And Eutropius was tempted to capitulate by the milder arts of persuasion, and by an oath that his life should be spared. Careless of the dignity of their sovereign, the new ministers of the palace immediately published an edict to declare that his late favorite had disgraced the names of consul and patrician, to abolish his statues, to confiscate his wealth, and to inflict a perpetual exile in the island of Cyprus. A despicable and decrepit eunuch could no longer alarm the fears of his enemies, nor was he capable of enjoying what yet remained, the comforts of peace, of solitude, and of a happy climate. But their implacable revenge still envied him the last moments of a miserable life. And Eutropius had no sooner touched the shores of Cyprus than he was hastily recalled. The vain hope of eluding by a change of place the obligation of an oath engaged the empress to transfer the scene of his trial and execution from Constantinople to the adjacent suburb of Chalcedon. The consul Aurelian pronounced the sentence, and the motives of that sentence exposed the jurisprudence of a despotic government. The crimes which Eutropius had committed against the people might have justified his death, but he was found guilty of harnessing to his chariot the sacred animals who, from their breed or color, were reserved for the use of the emperor alone. While this domestic revolution was transacted, Gainas openly revolted from his allegiance, united his forces at Thyatira in Lydia with those of Tribigilt, and still maintained his superior ascendant over the rebellious leader of the Ostrogoths. The confederate armies advanced without resistance to the straits of the Hellespont and the Bosphorus, and Arcadius was instructed to prevent the loss of his Asiatic dominions by resigning his authority and his person to the faith of the barbarians. The church of the holy martyr Euphemia, situated on a lofty eminence near Chalcedon, was chosen for the place of the interview. Gainas bowed with reverence at the feet of the emperor, whilst he required the sacrifice of Aurelian and Saturninus, two ministers of consular rank, and their naked necks were exposed by the haughty rebel to the edge of the sword, till he condescended to grant them a precarious and disgraceful respite. The Goths, according to the terms of the agreement, were immediately transported from Asia into Europe, and their victorious chief, who accepted the title of Master General of the Roman armies, soon filled Constantinople with his troops and distributed among his dependents the honors and rewards of the empire. In his early youth, Gainas had passed the Danube as a suppliant and a fugitive. His elevation had been the work of valor and fortune, and his indiscreet or perfidious conduct was the cause of his rapid downfall. Notwithstanding the vigorous opposition of the archbishop, he importunately claimed for his Arian sectaries the possession of a peculiar church, and the pride of the Catholics was offended by the public toleration of heresy. Every quarter of Constantinople was filled with tumult and disorder, and the barbarians gazed with such ardor on the rich shops of the jewelers and the tables of the bankers, which were covered with gold and silver, that it was judged prudent to remove those dangerous temptations from their sight. They resented the injurious precaution, and some alarming attempts were made during the night to attack and destroy with fire the imperial palace. In this state of mutual and suspicious hostility, the guards and the people of Constantinople shut the gates and rose in arms to prevent or to punish the conspiracy of the Goths. During the absence of Gainas, his troops were surprised and oppressed. 7,000 barbarians perished in this bloody massacre. In the fury of the pursuit, the Catholics uncovered the roof and continued to throw down flaming logs of wood till they overwhelmed their adversaries who had retreated to the church or conventicle of the Arians. Gainas was either innocent of the design or too confident of his success. He was astonished by the intelligence that the flower of his army had been ingloriously destroyed, that he himself was declared a public enemy, and that his countryman, Fravitta, a brave and loyal confederate, had assumed the management of the war by sea and land. The enterprises of the rebel against the cities of Thrace were encountered by a firm and well-ordered defense. His hungry soldiers were soon reduced to the grass that grew on the margin of the fortifications, and Gainas, who vainly regretted the wealth and luxury of Asia, embraced a desperate resolution of forcing the passage of the Hellespont. He was destitute of vessels, but the woods of the Chersonesus afforded materials for rafts, and his intrepid barbarians did not refuse to trust themselves to the waves. But Fravitta attentively watched the progress of their undertaking. As soon as they had gained the middle of the stream, the Roman galleys, impelled by the full force of oars, of the current, and of a favorable wind, rushed forwards in compact order and with irresistible weight, and the Hellespont was covered with the fragments of the Gothic shipwreck. After the destruction of his hopes and the loss of many thousands of his bravest soldiers, Gainas, who could no longer aspire to govern or to subdue the Romans, determined to resume the independence of a savage life. A light and active body of barbarian horse, disengaged from their infantry and baggage, might perform in 8 or 10 days a march of 300 miles from the Hellespont to the Danube. The garrisons of that important frontier had been gradually annihilated. The river in the month of December would be deeply frozen, and the unbounded prospect of Scythia was opened to the ambition of Gainas. This design was secretly communicated to the national troops, who devoted themselves to the fortunes of their leader, and before the signal of departure was given, a great number of provincial auxiliaries, whom he suspected of an attachment to their native country, were perfidiously massacred. The Goths advanced by rapid marches through the plains of Thrace, and they were soon delivered from the fear of a pursuit by the vanity of Fravitta, who, instead of extinguishing the war, hastened to enjoy the popular applause and to assume the peaceful honors of the consulship. But a formidable ally appeared in arms to vindicate the majesty of the empire and to guard the peace and liberty of Scythia. The superior forces of Uldin, king of the Huns, opposed the progress of Gainas. A hostile and ruined country prohibited his retreat. he disdained to capitulate, and after repeatedly attempting to cut his way through the ranks of the enemy, he was slain, with his desperate followers in the field of battle. 11 days after the naval victory of the Hellespont, the head of Gainas, the inestimable gift of the conqueror, was received at Constantinople with the most liberal expressions of gratitude. And the public deliverance was celebrated by festivals and illuminations. The triumphs of Arcadius became the subject of epic poems, and the monarch, no longer oppressed by any hostile terrors, resigned himself to the mild and absolute dominion of his wife, the fair and artful Eudoxia, who sullied her fame by the persecution of St. John Chrysostom. After the death of the indolent Nectarius, the successor of Gregory Nazianzen, the Church of Constantinople was distracted by the ambition of rival candidates who were not ashamed to solicit with gold or flattery the suffrage of the people or of the favorite. On this occasion, Eutropius seems to have deviated from his ordinary maxims, and his uncorrupted judgment was determined only by the superior merit of a stranger. In a late journey into the East, he had admired the sermons of John, a native and prester of Antioch, whose name has been distinguished by the epithet of Chrysostom, or the Golden Mouth. A private order was dispatched to the governor of Syria, and as the people might be unwilling to resign their favorite preacher, he was transported with speed and secrecy in a post-chariot from Antioch to Constantinople. The unanimous and unsolicited consent of the court, the clergy, and the people ratified the choice of the minister, and both as a saint and as an orator, the new archbishop surpassed the sanguine expectations of the public. Born of a noble and opulent family in the capital of Syria, Chrysostom had been educated by the care of a tender mother under the tuition of the most skillful masters. He studied the art of rhetoric in the school of Libanius, and that celebrated sophist, who soon discovered the talents of his disciple, ingenuously confessed that John would have deserved to succeed him had he not been stolen away by the Christians. His piety soon disposed him to receive the sacrament of baptism, to renounce the lucrative and honorable profession of the law, and to bury himself in the adjacent desert, where he subdued the lusts of the flesh by an austere penance of 6 years. His infirmities compelled him to return to the society of mankind, and the authority of Meletius devoted his talents to the service of the church. But in the midst of his family, and afterwards on the archiepiscopal throne, Chrysostom still persevered in the practice of the monastic virtues. The ample revenues which his predecessors had consumed in pomp and luxury, he diligently applied to the establishment of hospitals, and the multitudes who were supported by his charity preferred the eloquent and edifying discourses of their archbishop to the amusements of the theatre or the circus. The monuments of that eloquence, which was admired near 20 years at Antioch and Constantinople, have been carefully preserved, and the possession of near 1,000 sermons or homilies has authorized the critics of succeeding times to appreciate the genuine merit of Chrysostom. They unanimously attribute to the Christian orator the free command of an elegant and copious language. The judgment to conceal the advantages which he derived from the knowledge of rhetoric and philosophy, an inexhaustible fund of metaphors and similitudes of ideas and images to vary and illustrate the most familiar topics, the happy art of engaging the passions in the service of virtue, and of exposing the folly as well as the turpitude of vice, almost with the truth and spirit of a dramatic representation. The pastoral labors of the Archbishop of Constantinople provoked and gradually united against him two sorts of enemies, the aspiring clergy who envied his success, and the obstinate sinners who were offended by his reproofs. when Chrysostom thundered from the pulpit of Santa Sophia against the degeneracy of the Christians, his shafts were spent among the crowd without wounding or even marking the character of any individual. When he declaimed against the peculiar vices of the rich, poverty might obtain a transient consolation from his invectives. But the guilty were still sheltered by their numbers, and the reproach itself was dignified by some ideas of superiority and enjoyment. But as the pyramid rose towards the summit, it insensibly diminished to a point, and the magistrates, the ministers, the favorite eunuchs, the ladies of the court, the Empress Eudoxia herself, had a much larger share of guilt to divide among a smaller proportion of criminals. The personal applications of the audience were anticipated or confirmed by the testimony of their own conscience, and the intrepid preacher assumed the dangerous right of exposing both the offense and the offender to the public abhorrence. The secret resentment of the court encouraged the discontent of the clergy and monks of Constantinople, who were too hastily reformed by the fervent zeal of their archbishop. He had condemned from the pulpit the domestic females of the clergy of Constantinople, who, under the name of servants or sisters, afforded a perpetual occasion either of sin or of scandal. The silent and solitary ascetics who had secluded themselves from the world were entitled to the warmest approbation of Chrysostom. But he despised and stigmatized as the disgrace of their holy profession the crowd of degenerate monks who, from some unworthy motives of pleasure or profit, so frequently infested the streets of the capital. To the voice of persuasion the archbishop was obliged to add the terrors of authority, and his ardor in the exercise of ecclesiastical jurisdiction was not always exempt from passion, nor was it always guided by prudence. Chrysostom was naturally of a choleric disposition. Although he struggled, according to the precepts of the gospel, to love his private enemies, he indulged himself in the privilege of hating the enemies of God and of the church, and his sentiments were sometimes delivered with too much energy of countenance and expression. He still maintained, from some considerations of health or abstinence, his former habits of taking his repasts alone. And this inhospitable custom, which his enemies imputed to pride, contributed at least to nourish the infirmity of a morose and unsocial humor. Separated from that familiar intercourse which facilitates the knowledge and the dispatch of business, he reposed an unsuspecting confidence in his deacon Serapion, and seldom applied his speculative knowledge of human nature to the particular character either of his dependents or of his equals. Conscious of the purity of his intentions, and perhaps of the superiority of his genius, the Archbishop of Constantinople extended the jurisdiction of the imperial city, that he might enlarge the sphere of his pastoral labors, and the conduct which the profane imputed to an ambitious motive appeared to Chrysostom himself in the light of a sacred and indispensable duty. In his visitation through the Asiatic provinces, he deposed 13 bishops of Lydia and Phrygia, and indiscreetly declared that a deep corruption of simony and licentiousness had infected the whole episcopal order. If those bishops were innocent, such a rash and unjust condemnation must excite a well-grounded discontent. If they were guilty, the numerous associates of their guilt would soon discover that their own safety depended on the ruin of the archbishop, whom they studied to represent as the tyrant of the Eastern Church. This ecclesiastical conspiracy was managed by Theophilus, Archbishop of Alexandria, an active and ambitious prelate who displayed the fruits of rapine in monuments of ostentation. His national dislike to the rising greatness of a city which degraded him from the second to the third rank in the Christian world was exasperated by some personal dispute with Chrysostom himself. By the private invitation of the Empress, Theophilus landed at Constantinople with a stout body of Egyptian mariners to encounter the populace and a train of dependent bishops to secure by their voices the majority of a synod. The synod was convened in the suburb of Chalcodon, surnamed the Oak, where Rufinus had erected a stately church and monastery, and their proceedings were continued during 14 days or sessions. A bishop and a deacon accused the Archbishop of Constantinople, but the frivolous or improbable nature of the 47 articles which they presented against him may justly be considered as a fair and unexceptional panegyric. 4 successive summons were signified to Chrysostom, but he still refused to trust either his person or his reputation in the hands of his implacable enemies, who, prudently declining the examination of any particular charges, condemned his contumacious disobedience, and hastily pronounced a sentence of deposition. The Synod of the Oak immediately addressed the emperor to ratify and execute their judgment, and charitably insinuated that the penalties of treason might be inflicted on the audacious preacher who had reviled, under the name of Jezebel, the Empress Eudoxia herself. The archbishop was rudely arrested and conducted through the city by one of the imperial messengers, who landed him, after a short navigation, near the entrance of the Black Sea, from whence, before the expiration of 2 days, he was gloriously recalled. The first astonishment of his faithful people had been mute and passive. They suddenly rose with unanimous and irresistible fury. Theophilus escaped, but the promiscuous crowd of monks and Egyptian mariners was slaughtered without pity in the streets of Constantinople. A seasonable earthquake justified the interposition of heaven. The torrent of sedition rolled forwards to the gates of the palace, and the empress, agitated by fear or remorse, threw herself at the feet of Arcadius, and confessed that the public safety could be purchased only by the restoration of Chrysostom. The Bosphorus was covered with innumerable vessels. The shores of Europe and Asia were profusely illuminated, and the acclamations of a victorious people accompanied, from the port to the cathedral, the triumph of the archbishop, who too easily consented to resume the exercise of his functions before his sentence had been legally reversed by the authority of an ecclesiastical synod. Ignorant or careless of the impending danger, Chrysostom indulged his zeal, or perhaps his resentment, declaimed with peculiar asperity against female vices, and condemned the profane honors which were addressed almost in the precincts of Santa Sophia to the statue of the empress. His imprudence tempted his enemies to inflame the haughty spirit of Eudoxia by reporting, or perhaps inventing, the famous exordium of a sermon, "Herodias is again furious. Herodias again dances. She once more requires the head of John." An insolent allusion, which, as a woman and a sovereign, it was impossible for her to forgive. The short interval of a perfidious truce was employed to concert more effectual measures for the disgrace and ruin of the archbishop. A numerous council of the eastern prelates, who were guided from a distance by the advice of Theophilus, confirmed the validity without examining the justice of the former sentence, and a detachment of barbarian troops was introduced into the city to suppress the emotions of the people. On the vigil of Easter, the solemn administration of baptism was rudely interrupted by the soldiers, who alarmed the modesty of the naked catechumens and violated by their presence the awful mysteries of the Christian worship. Arsacius occupied the church of Santa Sophia and the archiepiscopal throne. The Catholics retreated to the baths of Constantine, and afterwards to the fields, where they were still pursued and insulted by the guards, the bishops, and the magistrates. The fatal day of the second and final exile of Chrysostom was marked by the conflagration of the cathedral, of the senate house, and of the adjacent buildings, and this calamity was imputed without proof, but not without probability, to the despair of a persecuted faction. Cicero might claim some merit if his voluntary banishment preserved the peace of the Republic, but the submission of Chrysostom was the indispensable duty of a Christian and a subject. Instead of listening to his humble prayer that he might be permitted to reside at Cyzicus or Nicomedia, the inflexible empress assigned for his exile the remote and desolate town of Cucusus, among the ridges of Mount Taurus in the Lesser Armenia. A secret hope was entertained that the archbishop might perish in a difficult and dangerous march of 70 days in the heat of summer through the provinces of Asia Minor, where he was continually threatened by the hostile attacks of the Isaurians and the more implacable fury of the monks. Yet Chrysostom arrived in safety at the place of his confinement, and the 3 years which he spent at Cucusus and the neighboring town of Arabesus were the last and most glorious of his life. His character was consecrated by absence and persecution. The faults of his administration were no longer remembered, but every tongue repeated the praises of his genius and virtue. And the respectful attention of the Christian world was fixed on a desert spot among the mountains of Taurus. From that solitude, the archbishop, whose active mind was invigorated by misfortunes, maintained a strict and frequent correspondence with the most distant provinces, exhorted the separate congregation of his faithful adherents to persevere in their allegiance, urged the destruction of the temples of Phoenicia, and the extirpation of heresy in the Isle of Cyprus, extended his pastoral care to the missions of Persia and Scythia, negotiated by his ambassadors with the Roman pontiff and the emperor Honorius, and boldly appealed from a partial synod to the supreme tribunal of a free and general council. The mind of the illustrious exile was still independent, but his captive body was exposed to the revenge of the oppressors, who continued to abuse the name and authority of Arcadius. An order was dispatched for the instant removal of Chrysostom to the extreme desert of Pityus, and his guards so faithfully obeyed their cruel instructions that before he reached the seacoast of the Black Sea, he expired at Comana in Pontus, in the 60th year of his age. The succeeding generation acknowledged his innocence and merit. The archbishops of the East, who might blush that their predecessors had been the enemies of Chrysostom, were gradually disposed by the firmness of the Roman pontiff to restore the honors of that venerable name. At the pious solicitation of the clergy and people of Constantinople, his relics, 30 years after his death, were transported from their obscure sepulchre to the royal city. The Emperor Theodosius advanced to receive them as far as Chalcedon, and falling prostrate on the coffin, implored, in the name of his guilty parents, Arcadius and Eudoxia, the forgiveness of the injured saint. Part 3. Yet a reasonable doubt may be entertained whether any stain of hereditary guilt could be derived from Arcadius to his successor. Eudoxia was a young and beautiful woman who indulged her passions and despised her husband. Count John enjoyed at least the familiar confidence of the empress, and the public named him as the real father of Theodosius the Younger. The birth of a son was accepted, however, by the pious husband as an event the most fortunate and honorable to himself, to his family, and to the Eastern world. And the royal infant, by an unprecedented favor, was invested with the titles of Caesar and Augustus. In less than 4 years afterwards, Eudoxia, in the bloom of youth, was destroyed by the consequences of a miscarriage. And this untimely death confounded the prophecy of a holy bishop who, amid the universal joy, had ventured to foretell that she should behold the long and auspicious reign of her glorious son. The Catholics applauded the justice of heaven, which avenged the persecution of Saint Chrysostom, and perhaps the emperor was the only person who sincerely bewailed the loss of the haughty and rapacious Eudoxia. Such a domestic misfortune afflicted him more deeply than the public calamities of the East, the licentious excursions from Pontus to Palestine of the Isaurian robbers, whose impunity accused the weakness of the government, and the earthquakes, the conflagrations, the famine, and the flights of locusts, which the popular discontent was equally disposed to attribute to the incapacity of the monarch. At length, in the 31st year of his age, after a reign, if we may abuse that word, of 13 years, 3 months, and 15 days, Arcadius expired in the palace of Constantinople. It is impossible to delineate his character, since in a period very copiously furnished with historical materials, it has not been possible to remark one action that properly belongs to the son of the great Theodosius. The historian Procopius has indeed illuminated the mind of the dying emperor with a ray of human prudence or celestial wisdom. Arcadius considered with anxious foresight the helpless condition of his son Theodosius, who was no more than 7 years of age, the dangerous factions of a minority, and the aspiring spirit of Gesdegerd, the Persian monarch. Instead of tempting the allegiance of an ambitious subject by the participation of supreme power, he boldly appealed to the magnanimity of a king, and placed, by a solemn testament, the scepter of the East in the hands of Gesdegerd himself. The royal guardian accepted and discharged this honorable trust with unexampled fidelity, and the infancy of Theodosius was protected by the arms and counsels of Persia. Such is the singular narrative of Procopius, and his veracity is not disputed by Agathias, while he presumes to dissent from his judgment and to arraign the wisdom of a Christian emperor who, so rashly, though so fortunately, committed his son and his dominions to the unknown faith of a stranger, a rival, and a heathen. At the distance of 150 years, this political question might be debated in the court of Justinian. But a prudent historian will refuse to examine the propriety till he has ascertained the truth of the testament of Arcadius. As it stands without a parallel in the history of the world, we may justly require that it should be attested by the positive and unanimous evidence of contemporaries. The strange novelty of the event, which excites our distrust, must have attracted their notice, and their universal silence annihilates the vain tradition of the succeeding age. The maxims of Roman jurisprudence, if they could fairly be transferred from private property to public dominion, would have adjudged to the Emperor Honorius the guardianship of his nephew till he had attained at least the 14th year of his age. But the weakness of Honorius and the calamities of his reign disqualified him from prosecuting this natural claim, and such was the absolute separation of the two monarchies, both in interest and affection, that Constantinople would have obeyed with less reluctance the orders of the Persian than those of the Italian court. Under a prince whose weakness is disguised by the external signs of manhood and discretion, the most worthless favorites may secretly dispute the empire of the palace, and dictate to submissive provinces the commands of a master whom they direct and despise. But the ministers of a child, who is incapable of arming them with the sanction of the royal name, must acquire and exercise an independent authority. The great officers of the state and army, who had been appointed before the death of Arcadius, formed an aristocracy which might have inspired them with the idea of a free republic. And the government of the Eastern Empire was fortunately assumed by the prefect Anthemius, who obtained by his superior abilities a lasting ascendant over the minds of his equals. The safety of the young emperor proved the merit and integrity of Anthemius, and his prudent firmness sustained the force and reputation of an infant reign. Uldin, with a formidable host of barbarians, was encamped in the heart of Thrace. He proudly rejected all terms of accommodation, and, pointing to the rising sun, declared to the Roman ambassadors that the course of that planet should alone terminate the conquest of the Huns. But the desertion of his confederates, who were privately convinced of the justice and liberality of the imperial ministers, obliged Uldin to repass the Danube. The tribe of the Scyri, which composed his rear guard, was almost extirpated, and many thousand captives were dispersed to cultivate with servile labor the fields of Asia. In the midst of the public triumph, Constantinople was protected by a strong enclosure of new and more extensive walls. The same vigilant care was applied to restore the fortifications of the Illyrian cities, and a plan was judiciously conceived which, in the space of 7 years, would have secured the command of the Danube by establishing on that river a perpetual fleet of 250 armed vessels. But the Romans had so long been accustomed to the authority of a monarch that the first, even among the females of the imperial family, who displayed any courage or capacity, was permitted to ascend the vacant throne of Theodosius. His sister, Pulcheria, who was only 2 years older than himself, received at the age of 16 the title of Augusta, and though her favor might be sometimes clouded by caprice or intrigue, she continued to govern the Eastern Empire near 40 years, during the long minority of her brother, and after his death in her own name and in the name of Marcian, her nominal husband. From a motive either of prudence or religion, she embraced a life of celibacy, and notwithstanding some aspersions on the chastity of Pulcheria, this resolution, which she communicated to her sisters Arcadia and Marina, was celebrated by the Christian world as the sublime effort of heroic piety. In the presence of the clergy and people, the three daughters of Arcadius dedicated their virginity to God, and the obligation of their solemn vow was inscribed on a tablet of gold and gems, which they publicly offered in the great church of Constantinople. Their palace was converted into a monastery, and all males, except the guides of their conscience, the saints who had forgotten the distinction of sexes, were scrupulously excluded from the holy threshold. Pulcheria, her two sisters, and a chosen train of favorite damsels formed a religious community. They denounced the vanity of dress, interrupted by frequent fasts, their simple and frugal diet, allotted a portion of their time to works of embroidery, and devoted several hours of the day and night to the exercises of prayer and psalmody. The piety of a Christian virgin was adorned by the zeal and liberality of an empress. Ecclesiastical history describes the splendid churches which were built at the expense of Pulcheria in all the provinces of the East, her charitable foundations for the benefit of strangers and the poor, the ample donations which she assigned for the perpetual maintenance of monastic societies, and the active severity with which she labored to suppress the opposite heresies of Nestorius and Eutyches. Such virtues were supposed to deserve the peculiar favor of the deity, and the relics of martyrs, as well as the knowledge of future saints, were communicated in visions and revelations to the imperial saint. Yet the devotion of Pulcheria never diverted her indefatigable attention from temporal affairs, and she alone, among all the descendants of the great Theodosius, appears to have inherited any share of his manly spirit and abilities. The elegant and familiar use which she had acquired, both of the Greek and Latin languages, was readily applied to the various occasions of speaking or writing on public business. Her deliberations were maturely weighed. Her actions were prompt and decisive. And while she moved without noise or ostentation the wheel of government, she discreetly attributed to the genius of the emperor the long tranquillity of his reign. In the last years of his peaceful life, Europe was indeed afflicted by the arms of war. But the more extensive provinces of Asia still continued to enjoy a profound and permanent repose. Theodosius the Younger was never reduced to the disgraceful necessity of encountering and punishing a rebellious subject, and since we cannot applaud the vigor, some praise may be due to the mildness and prosperity of the administration of Pulcheria. The Roman world was deeply interested in the education of its master. A regular course of study and exercise was judiciously instituted. Of the military exercises of riding and shooting with the bow, of the liberal studies of grammar, rhetoric, and philosophy. The most skillful masters of the East ambitiously solicited the attention of their royal pupil, and several noble youths were introduced into the palace to animate his diligence by the emulation of friendship. Pulcheria alone discharged the important task of instructing her brother in the arts of government, but her precepts may countenance some suspicions of the extent of her capacity or of the purity of her intentions. She taught him to maintain a grave and majestic deportment, to walk, to hold his robes, to seat himself on his throne in a manner worthy of a great prince, to abstain from laughter, to listen with condescension, to return suitable answers, to assume by turns a serious or a placid countenance. In a word, to represent with grace and dignity the external figure of a Roman emperor. But Theodosius was never excited to support the weight and glory of an illustrious name, and instead of aspiring to support his ancestors, he degenerated, if we may presume to measure the degrees of incapacity, below the weakness of his father and his uncle. Arcadius and Honorius had been assisted by the guardian care of a parent, whose lessons were enforced by his authority and example. But the unfortunate prince who is born in the purple must remain a stranger to the voice of truth, and the son of Arcadius was condemned to pass his perpetual infancy encompassed only by a servile train of women and eunuchs. The ample leisure which he acquired by neglecting the essential duties of his high office was filled by idle amusements and unprofitable studies. Hunting was the only active pursuit that could tempt him beyond the limits of the palace, but he most assiduously labored, sometimes by the light of a midnight lamp, in the mechanic occupations of painting and carving, and the elegance with which he transcribed religious books entitled the Roman emperor to the singular epithet of calligraphes, or a fair writer. Separated from the world by an impenetrable veil, Theodosius trusted the persons whom he loved. He loved those who were accustomed to amuse and flatter his indolence, and as he never perused the papers that were presented for the royal signature, the acts of injustice the most repugnant to his character were frequently perpetrated in his name. The emperor himself was chaste, temperate, liberal, and merciful. But these qualities, which can only deserve the name of virtues when they are supported by courage and regulated by discretion, were seldom beneficial, and they sometimes proved mischievous to mankind. His mind, innervated by royal education, was oppressed and degraded by abject superstition. He fasted, he sung psalms, he blindly accepted the miracles and doctrines with which his faith was continually nourished. Theodosius devoutly worshipped the dead and living saints of the Catholic Church, and he once refused to eat till an insolent monk who had cast an excommunication on his sovereign condescended to heal the spiritual wound which he had inflicted. The story of a fair and virtuous maiden exalted from a private condition to the imperial throne might be deemed an incredible romance, if such a romance had not been verified in the marriage of Theodosius. The celebrated Athenaeus was educated by her father Leontius in the religion and sciences of the Greeks, and so advantageous was the opinion which the Athenian philosopher entertained of his contemporaries, that he divided his patrimony between his two sons, bequeathing to his daughter a small legacy of 100 pieces of gold, in the lively confidence that her beauty and merit would be a sufficient portion. The jealousy and avarice of her brothers soon compelled Athenaeus to seek a refuge at Constantinople, and with some hopes either of justice or favour to throw herself at the feet of Pulcheria. That sagacious princess listened to her eloquent complaint, and secretly destined the daughter of the philosopher Leontius for the future wife of the Emperor of the East, who had now attained the 20th year of his age. She easily excited the curiosity of her brother by an interesting picture of the charms of Athenaeus. Large eyes, a well-proportioned nose, a fair complexion, golden locks, a slender person, a graceful demeanour, an understanding improved by study, and a virtue tried by distress. Theodosius, concealed behind a curtain in the apartment of his sister, was permitted to behold the Athenian virgin. The modest youth immediately declared his pure and honourable love, and the royal nuptials were celebrated amidst the acclamations of the capital and the provinces. Athenaeus, who was easily persuaded to renounce the errors of paganism, received at her baptism the Christian name of Eudokia. But the cautious Pulcheria withheld the title of Augusta till the wife of Theodosius had approved her fruitfulness by the birth of a daughter, who espoused 15 years afterwards the Emperor of the West. The brothers of Eudokia obeyed with some anxiety her imperial summons, but as she could easily forgive their unfortunate unkindness, she indulged the tenderness or perhaps the vanity of a sister by promoting them to the rank of consuls and prefects. In the luxury of the palace she still cultivated those ingenuous arts which had contributed to her greatness, and wisely dedicated her talents to the honour of religion and of her husband. Eudokia composed a poetical paraphrase of the first 8 books of the Old Testament, and of the prophecies of Daniel and Zechariah. A cento of the verses of Homer applied to the life and miracles of Christ, the legend of Saint Cyprian, and a panegyric on the Persian victories of Theodosius. And her writings, which were applauded by a servile and superstitious age, have not been disdained by the candour of impartial criticism. The fondness of the emperor was not abated by time and possession, and Eudokia, after the marriage of her daughter, was permitted to discharge her grateful vows by solemn pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Her ostentatious progress through the East may seem inconsistent with the spirit of Christian humility. She pronounced from a throne of golden gems an eloquent oration to the Senate of Antioch, declared her royal intention of enlarging the walls of the city, bestowed a donative of 200 pounds of gold to restore the public baths, and accepted the statues which were decreed by the gratitude of Antioch. In the Holy Land her alms and pious foundations exceeded the munificence of the great Helena, and though the public treasure might be impoverished by this excessive liberality, she enjoyed the conscious satisfaction of returning to Constantinople with the chains of St. Peter, the right arm of St. Stephen, and an undoubted picture of the Virgin painted by St. Luke. But this pilgrimage was the fatal term of the glories of Eudokia. Satiated with empty pomp and unmindful, perhaps, of her obligations to Pulcheria, she ambitiously aspired to the government of the Eastern Empire. The palace was distracted by female discord, but the victory was at last decided by the superior ascendant of the sister of Theodosius. The execution of Paulinus, master of the offices, and the disgrace of Cyrus, praetorian prefect of the East, convinced the public that the favour of Eudokia was insufficient to protect her most faithful friends, and the uncommon beauty of Paulinus encouraged the secret rumour that his guilt was that of a successful lover. As soon as the Empress perceived that the affection of Theodosius was irretrievably lost, she requested the permission of retiring to the distant solitude of Jerusalem. She obtained her request, but the jealousy of Theodosius, or the vindictive spirit of Pulcheria, pursued her in her last retreat, and Saturninus, count of the domestics, was directed to punish with death two ecclesiastics, her most favoured servants. Eudocia instantly revenged them by the assassination of the count. The furious passions which she indulged on this suspicious occasion seemed to justify the severity of Theodosius, and the empress, ignominiously stripped of the honours of her rank, was disgraced, perhaps unjustly, in the eyes of the world. The remainder of the life of Eudocia, about 16 years, was spent in exile and devotion, and the approach of age, the death of Theodosius, the misfortunes of her only daughter, who was led a captive from Rome to Carthage, and the society of the holy monks of Palestine, insensibly confirmed the religious temper of her mind. After a full experience of the vicissitudes of human life, the daughter of the philosopher Leontius expired at Jerusalem in the 67th year of her age, protesting, with her dying breath, that she had never transgressed the bounds of innocence and friendship. The gentle mind of Theodosius was never inflamed by the ambition of conquest or military renown, and the slight alarm of a Persian war scarcely interrupted the tranquillity of the East. The motives of this war were just and honourable. In the last year of the reign of Jezdegerd, the supposed guardian of Theodosius, a bishop who aspired to the crown of martyrdom destroyed one of the fire temples of Susa. His zeal and obstinacy were revenged on his brethren. The Magi excited a cruel persecution, and the intolerant zeal of Jezdegerd was imitated by his son Varanes, or Bahram, who soon afterwards ascended the throne. Some Christian fugitives who escaped to the Roman frontier were sternly demanded and generously refused, and the refusal, aggravated by commercial disputes, soon kindled a war between the rival monarchies. The mountains of Armenia and the plains of Mesopotamia were filled with hostile armies, but the operations of two successive campaigns were not productive of any decisive or memorable events. Some engagements were fought, some towns were besieged with various and doubtful success. And if the Romans failed in their attempt to recover the long-lost possession of Nisibis, the Persians were repulsed from the walls of a Mesopotamian city by the valour of a martial bishop, who pointed his thundering engine in the name of St. Thomas the Apostle. Yet the splendid victories which the incredible speed of the messenger Palladius repeatedly announced to the palace of Constantinople were celebrated with festivals and panegyrics. From these panegyrics the historians of the age might borrow their extraordinary and perhaps fabulous tales of the proud challenge of a Persian hero who was entangled by the net and dispatched by the sword of Ariobendus the Goth, of the 10,000 immortals who were slain in the attack of the Roman camp, and of the 100,000 Arabs or Saracens who were impelled by panic terror to throw themselves headlong into the Euphrates. Such events may be disbelieved or disregarded, but the charity of a bishop, Acacius of Amida, whose name might have dignified the saintly calendar, shall not be lost in oblivion. Boldly declaring that vases of gold and silver are useless to a god who neither eats nor drinks, the generous prelate sold the plate of the church of Amida, employed the price in the redemption of 7,000 Persian captives, supplied their wants with affectionate liberality, and dismissed them to their native country to inform their king of the true spirit of the religion which he persecuted. The practice of benevolence in the midst of war must always tend to assuage the animosity of contending nations, and I wish to persuade myself that Acacius contributed to the restoration of peace. In the conference which was held on the limits of the two empires, the Roman ambassadors degraded the personal character of their sovereign by a vain attempt to magnify the extent of his power, when they seriously advised the Persians to prevent, by a timely accommodation, the wrath of a monarch who was yet ignorant of this distant war. A truce of 100 years was solemnly ratified, and although the revolutions of Armenia might threaten the public tranquillity, the essential conditions of this treaty were respected near 80 years by the successors of Constantine and Artaxerxes. Since the Roman and Parthian standards first encountered on the banks of the Euphrates, the kingdom of Armenia was alternately oppressed by its formidable protectors, and in the course of this history, several events which inclined the balance of peace and war have been already related. A disgraceful treaty had resigned Armenia to the ambition of Sapor, and the scale of Persia appeared to preponderate. But the royal race of Arsaces impatiently submitted to the house of Sasan. The turbulent nobles asserted, or betrayed, their hereditary independence, and the nation was still attached to the Christian princes of Constantinople. In the beginning of the 5th century, Armenia was divided by the progress of war and faction, and the unnatural division precipitated the downfall of that ancient monarchy. Khosroes, the Persian vassal, reigned over the eastern and most extensive portion of the country, while the western province acknowledged the jurisdiction of Arsaces and the supremacy of the emperor Arcadius. After the death of Arsaces, the Romans suppressed the regal government and imposed on their allies the condition of subjects. The military command was delegated to the count of the Armenian frontier. The city of Theodosiopolis was built and fortified in a strong situation on a fertile and lofty ground near the sources of the Euphrates, and the dependent territories were ruled by 5 satraps, whose dignity was marked by a peculiar habit of gold and purple. The less fortunate nobles, who lamented the loss of their king and envied the honors of their equals, were provoked to negotiate their peace and pardon at the Persian court, and returning with their followers to the palace of Artaxata, acknowledged Khosroes for their lawful sovereign. About 30 years afterwards, Artaxerxes, the nephew and successor of Khosroes, fell under the displeasure of the haughty and capricious nobles of Armenia, and they unanimously desired a Persian governor in the room of an unworthy king. The answer of the Archbishop Isaac, whose sanction they earnestly solicited, is expressive of the character of a superstitious people. He deplored the manifest and inexcusable vices of Artaxerxes, and declared that he should not hesitate to accuse him before the tribunal of a Christian emperor, who would punish without destroying the sinner. "Our king," continued Isaac, "is too much addicted to licentious pleasures, but he has been purified in the holy waters of baptism. He is a lover of women, but he does not adore the fire or the elements. He may deserve the reproach of lewdness, but he is an undoubted Catholic, and his faith is pure, though his manners are flagitious. I will never consent to abandon my sheep to the rage of devouring wolves, and you would soon repent your rash exchange of the infirmities of a believer for the specious virtues of a heathen." Exasperated by the firmness of Isaac, the factious nobles accused